Wendell blinked. As Solon had guessed, Wendell knew, but he hadn't wanted to let Solon know how extensive his network of eyes and ears was. After a moment, the steward said, "The matter might have been handled fairly easily, but the king doesn't let the queen make any decisions without him. He interrupted them while they were speaking. He said that he would take the matter under advisement. I'm sorry. I don't know what that means." "I'm afraid I do," Solon said.
"What?"
Logan asked. "Who's your family's solicitor?"
"I asked you first," Logan said.
"Boy."
"Count Rimbold Drake," Logan said, sulking a little.
"It means we need to speak with Count Drake. Now."
"Do I have to wear the shoes?" Azoth asked. He didn't like shoes. You couldn't feel the ground to know how slick it was, and they pinched.
"Nah. We'll go see Count Drake with you wearing a nobleman's tunic and barefoot," Durzo said.
"Really?"
"No."
For all the times Azoth had envied the merchants and lords' sons at the markets, he'd never thought of how uncomfortable their clothes were. But Durzo was his master now, and he was already impatient with how long it was taking Azoth to get ready. So Azoth kept his mouth shut. He hadn't been Durzo's apprentice for long, and he still worried the wet boy would throw him out. They walked across Vanden Bridge to the east side. To Azoth, it was a revelation. He'd never even tried to cross Vanden Bridge, and hadn't believed the guild rats who claimed to have made it past the guards. On the east side of the river, there were no ruins, no empty buildings at all. There were no beggars on the streets. It smelled different, foreign, alien. Azoth couldn't smell the manure of the cattle yards at all. Even the gutters were different. There was only one every third street, and none in the major streets. People didn't just throw their slops and sewage out the windows and let them accumulate until they gradually flowed away. Here, they carried them to the third street and dumped them there to flow down stone channels in the cobblestone streets so that even those streets were safe to walk in. Most alarming, though, was that the people smelled wrong. Men didn't smell of sweat and their labors. When a woman passed, she smelled only lightly of perfume, rather than overpoweringly of it with the stale odors of sweat and sex laced underneath. When Azoth asked Blint about it, the wet boy just said,
"You're going to be a lot of work, aren't you?"
They passed a wide building that was billowing steam. Glistening, perfectly coiffed men and women were emerging. Azoth didn't even ask.
"It's a bathhouse," Blint said. "Another Seorin import. The only difference is that here the men and women bathe separately. Except in Mama Kay's, of course."
The owner of the Tipsy Tart greeted Blint as Master Tuli. He answered her with an accent and an effete attitude and ordered his carriage brought around. Once they were underway, Azoth asked,
"Where are we going? Who's Count Drake?"
"He's an old friend, a noble who has to work for a living. He's a solicitor."
When Azoth looked puzzled, Master Blint said, "A solicitor is a man who does worse things within the law than most crooks do outside it. But he's a good man. He's going to help me make you useful."
"Master?" Azoth asked. "How's Doll Girl?"
"She's not your problem anymore. You're not to ask about her again."
A minute passed as the streets rolled by. Durzo finally said,
"She's in bad shape, but she'll live."
He said nothing more until they were shown into the Count's tiny estate. Count Drake was a kindly-looking man of perhaps 40. He had a pince-nez tucked in a pocket of his vest, and he limped as he closed the door behind them and took a seat behind a desk piled high with stacks of papers.
"I never thought you'd take an apprentice, Durzo. In fact, I seem to remember you swearing it, and swearing at great length, the Count said.
And I still believe every word I said, Durzo said gruffly.
Ah, you're either being terrifically subtle or making no sense at all, my friend.
Count Drake smiled, though, and Azoth could tell it was a real smile, without malice or calculation. Despite himself, Durzo smiled, too.
They've been missing you, Rimbold.
Really? I wasn't aware of anyone shooting at me for some time.
Durzo laughed, and Azoth almost fell out of his chair. He hadn't thought the wet boy was capable of laughter.
I need your help, Durzo said. All I have is yours, Durzo. I want to make this boy new.
What are you thinking?
Count Drake asked, looking at Azoth quizzically.
A noble of some sort, relatively poor. The kind who gets invited to social events but doesn't attract attention.
Count Drake said. The third son of a baron, then. He'll be upper nobility, but nobody important. Or wait, an eastern baron. My second cousins live 2 days' ride beyond Havamir, and most of their lands have been seized by the Lee Nought. So, if you want an ironclad identity, we could make him a stern.
That will do. First name? Count Drake asked Azoth.
Azoth, Azoth said.
Not your real name, son, the Count said.
Your new name.
Kylar, Durzo said.
The Count produced a piece of blank paper and put on the pince-nez.
How do you want to spell that?
K-Y-L-E-R? K-I-L-E-R?
Durzo spelled it, and the solicitor wrote it down. Count Drake grinned.
Old Jaren punning?
You know me, Durzo said.
No, Durzo, I don't think anyone does. Still, kind of ominous, don't you think?
It fits the life.
For about the 100th time, Azoth felt like he was not simply a child, but an outsider. It seemed everywhere there were secrets that he couldn't know, mysteries he couldn't penetrate. Now it wasn't just muted conversations with Mama Kay about something called a Kakari or Sakage politics, or court intrigues or magic, or creatures from the Freeze that were imaginary, but Durzo insisted did exist, or others that he insisted didn't, or references to gods and angels that Blint wouldn't explain to him, even when he did ask. Now it was his own name. Azoth was about to demand an explanation, but they were already moving on to other things.
The Count said, "How soon do you need this, and how solid does it have to be?"
"Solid. Sooner is better."
"I thought so," the Count said. "I'll make it good enough that unless the real Sterns come here, no one will ever know. Of course, you're still left with a rather significant problem. You have to train him to be a noble."
"Oh, no, I don't."
"Of course you—"
The Count trailed off. He clicked his tongue.
"I see."
He adjusted his pince-nez and looked at Azoth.
"When shall I take him?"
"In a few months. If he lives that long. There are things I need to teach him first."
Durzo looked out the window.
"Who's that?"
"Ah," Count Drake said. "That's the young Lord Logan Gyre, a man who will make a fine duke one day."
"No. The Sethi."
"I don't know. Haven't seen him before. Looks like an advisor."
Durzo cursed. He grabbed Azoth's hand and practically dragged him out the door.
"Are you ready to obey?"
Durzo demanded.
Azoth nodded quickly.
"See that boy?"
"You call that a boy?" Azoth asked. The young man the Count had called Logan Gyre wore a green cloak with black piping, fine black leather boots polished to a high sheen, a cotton tunic, and a sword. He was 20 paces from the door and was being shown in by a porter, His face looked young, but his frame made him look years older than Azoth. He was huge, already taller than Azoth would probably ever be, and thicker and wider than anyone he knew, and he didn't look fat. Where Azoth felt awkward and clumsy in his clothes, Logan looked comfortable, confident, handsome, lordly. Just looking at him made Azoth feel shabby.
"Start a fight with him. Distract the Sethi until I can get out."
"Logan!" a girl cried out from upstairs. "Sira!" Logan called, looking up. Azoth looked at Master Blint, but he was gone. There was no time to say anything. It didn't matter whether he understood or not. There were mysteries he wasn't allowed to understand yet. He could only act or wait, obey or disobey. The porter opened the door, and Azoth stepped back around the corner, out of sight. As Logan stepped inside and looked up the stairs, a smile curving his lips, Azoth stepped around the corner. They collided, and Azoth landed on his back. Logan almost tripped over him as Azoth rolled to the side and caught Logan's foot in the stomach.
"Oof!"
Logan caught himself on the banister. "I'm so sorry."
"You fat ape!"
Azoth staggered to his feet, holding his stomach.
"You clumsy gutter shite!"
He cut off as he realized all the curses he knew would mark him as coming from the Warrens.
"I didn't..." Logan said.
"What's going on?"
the girl asked from the top of the stairs. Logan looked up, a guilty look flashing across his face. Azoth punched him in the nose. Logan's head rocked back.
"Logan!" the Sethi man shouted.
Logan's mild expression was gone. His face was a mask, intense but not furious. He grabbed Azoth's cloak and lifted him off the ground. Azoth panicked. He threw punches blindly, screaming, his fists grazing Logan's cheeks and chin.
"Logan!"
"Stop it!"
Logan shouted in Azoth's face.
"Stop it!"
Azoth went crazy, and Logan's intensity flashed into fury. He shifted his hands and held Azoth off the ground with one, then buried his other fist in Azoth's stomach. Once, twice. The wind rushed from Azoth's lungs. Then a fist, the size of a sledge, flattened his nose, blinding him with instant tears and pain. Then, amid distant shouting, he felt himself being spun in a tight circle and, briefly, flying. Azoth's head slapped against hard wood, and the world flashed bright. Chapter 14. Logan had insisted on going upstairs to help the Countess take care of young Kylar Stern. He was mortified, and apparently not solely because he'd lost his temper in front of Count Drake's pretty daughter. For Solon, it had been an instructive 10 seconds. Count Drake and Solon were left alone. The Count led him to his office.
"Why don't you sit down?" the Count said, taking his own seat behind the desk. "Where are you from, Master Tophusen?"
It was either courtesy or bait. Solon chuckled.
"That's the first time I've been asked that question."
He gestured to himself as if to say, "Just look at my skin." The Count said,
"I don't see any clan rings or any scars where they've been removed."
"Well, not all Sethi wear the rings."
"I was under the distinct impression that they did,"
Count Drake said.
"What is this?"
"What are you after?"
"I'm curious about who you really are, Master Tophusen. Logan Gyre is not only a fine young man whom I regard almost as a son, he's also suddenly the lord of one of the most powerful houses in the land. I've never seen you or heard of you, and suddenly you're his advisor. That strikes me as peculiar. I don't care that you're Sethi, if you are.
but I've spent some time on Hokai and Togathu, and the only Sethi who don't pierce their cheeks are the exiles stripped of clan and family. But if you are an exile, you should have scars from your rings being torn out, and you have none. Your knowledge of our culture is admirable, but incomplete. I am of House Tofusen, Windseekers of the Royal House. My father's appointment was to Shosendi.
An ambassador to the Red Mages?
Yes. Shosendi accepts students from all over the world. As I had no magical talent, I received my education among the merchants and nobles who are not as tolerant. Not having the rings made life a little easier. There's more to it than that, but I don't think the rest of my story is any of your business.
Fair enough.
What took you to Seth? Solon asked.
Slavery, the Count said. Before I became fully part of the movement that finally ended slavery here 7 years ago, I thought a more moderate path might work. I went to Hokai to see if I could learn ways to make slaves' lives better.
From the small size of his house, which was very small for a noble, even one as low as a count, Solon knew that Count Drake hadn't been one of the slavers who felt guilty about his newfound wealth. He must have been a real crusader all along.
It's totally different in Seth, Solon said.
The year of joy changes everything.
Yes, I advanced the idea here, even got the law passed, but the Sakage immediately suborned it. Instead of every slave being freed on the 7th year, slaves were to be freed 7 years from the beginning of their indenture. The Sakage claimed it was simpler, that it would be ridiculous to buy a slave in the 6th year and own them for only a month or a week. Of course, in practice, the Sakage's people kept the records, so where in your country the 7th year is full of celebration as every slave is freed, here the years passed and slaves were never freed. Slaves became slaves for life. They were beaten, scourged, given to death games, their children sent to the baby farms.
I've heard those became truly awful, Solon said.
The Sakage set them up, saying that they would be places where the children of prostitutes might be redeemed. Slaves, true, but redeemed. It sounded good, but it gave us places like the House of Mercy. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't go on. It was a dark time.
Is that boy ever coming down?
Maybe we should get started, Solon said.
I don't think this will wait, and from the way Logan was looking at your daughter, they might be talking a while.
The Count chuckled. Are you testing me now?
Does Duke Jaya know?
Yes. He and I are friends. Regnus is loath to demand control of Logan's flirtations given the circumstances of his own marriage.
I'm not familiar with those. Can you enlighten me? Solon asked.
It's not my place. Anyway, Logan and Cyril will grow out of it. What appears to be the problem?
Katrina Jaya.
Careful, the Count said.
Did the Duke give you letters that declared his son Lord Jaya in his absence?
He spoke of it, but he had to leave quickly. He said his steward would bring them.
Lady Jaya has stolen the letters and destroyed them. Then she went to the Queen.
She went to whom?
The Count was astonished.
Is that unusual?
They have no love for each other.
What happened? Count Drake asked.
Lady Jaya asked to be made Logan's guardian. The King overheard them. He came in and said he would take it under advisement.
What does that mean?
Count Drake removed his pince-nez and rubbed the bridge of his nose.
It means that if he acts quickly, he can appoint a guardian for Logan.
Will Katrina Jaya do such a poor job? Solon asked.
Count Drake sighed. Legally, the King can put anyone in Logan's place that he wants, so long as they're related to him, which means almost anyone in the nobility. And once he's got a guardian in place,
Even Regnus won't be able to rescind the appointment. Katrina has just delivered House Jaya to the king.
But you're Duke Jaya's solicitor, and he told you his wishes. Doesn't that carry any weight? Solon asked.
If the king were interested in truth, yes. As is, to save the Jayas, we'd need the Jaya family parchment, the Duke's great seal, and a reckless willingness to forge a state document. The king holds court in half an hour. I'd guess this will be the first item on the agenda. There's just no time.
Solon cleared his throat and produced a roll of heavy parchment and a large seal.
Count Drake grinned and snatched the parchment. I think I suddenly like you, Master Tophusen.
Wendell Noth helped me with the wording, Solon said. I thought I'd leave the signature and the seal to you. Count Drake rummaged through his desk, found a letter from the Duke, and laid it on top of the writ of guardianship. With quick, sure strokes, he forged the Duke's signature flawlessly. Count Drake looked up guiltily and said,
Let's just call it an artifact of a misspent youth.
Solon dribbled sealing wax on the parchment.
Then, here's to misspent youth.
Next time you'll move, Blint said, as Azoth groaned his way back into consciousness.
I don't think I'll ever move again. My head feels like someone threw it against a wall.
Blint laughed. The second time Azoth had heard him do that recently. He was sitting on the edge of Azoth's bed.
You did well.
They thought you were embarrassed because you got knocked down in front of Drake's daughter, so they decided it was all harmless kid stuff.
The young Lord Gyre was mortified that he hid you. Apparently he's a real big friendly giant, never loses his temper. The fact you're about a quarter his size and Sira was furious with him also helps. They were all quite impressed.
Impressed? That's stupid.
In their world, fighting has rules. So fighting means risking embarrassment and pain, and at worst, risking your looks if you get a broken nose or an unfortunate scar. It doesn't mean dying or killing. In their world, you can fight a man and then become his friend. In fact, you're going to play it so Logan does become your friend. Because with a man like him, you can only come out of this as a great friend, or a terrible enemy. Do you understand that, Kylar? We'll work together on your new identity soon.
Yes, sir. Sir, why didn't you want Master Tophusen to see you? That's why you made me fight Logan, isn't it? To be a distraction?
Solon Tophusen is a magus. Most magi, that's male mages, can't tell if you're talented just by looking at you. On the other hand, most magi, female mages, can. There are disguises against their sight that I'll teach you later, but I didn't have time to do it, and I didn't feel like going upstairs and jumping out a window.
Azoth was confused.
But he doesn't act like a mage.
And how would you know? Durzo asked.
Azoth didn't think saying he isn't like the mages in stories was going to please Durzo.
The truth is, Durzo said, Solon hasn't told Logan or anyone else that he's a mage. And you won't tell anyone either. When you know a man's secrets, you have power over him. A man's secret is his weakness. Every man has his weakness. No matter.
Master Blint's voice dropped to nothing, his eyes suddenly distant, lifeless. He stood and left without a word. Azoth closed his eyes, confused. He wondered about his new master. He wondered about the guild. He wondered if Jalaliel had bought review. He wondered how Jarl was doing. Most of all, he wondered about Dahlgirl.
Hey-ho, Azo.
Hey-ho, J-O, Azoth said. Even as he gave the words the same stress he always had,
Azoth felt part of himself die. This was supposed to be one of his last outings as Azoth. Soon, he would have to become Kylar. He would walk differently, talk differently. He wouldn't ever visit his old neighborhoods in the Warrens. But now, he saw that Azoth's world was already dying, that he would never connect with Jarl again. It had nothing to do with lies Kylar would tell, and everything to do with Rat. It was different now. It always would be. Azoth and Jarl looked at each other for a long moment in the common room of Mama Kay's house. It was almost midnight, and the guild rats would soon be shooed out of the house. They were welcome in the common room all day, but they were allowed to sleep here only in the winter. And then, only if they obeyed her rules. No fighting, no stealing, no going anywhere but the kitchen and the common room, and no bothering the adults who visited. Any guild rat who broke the rules got his entire guild banned from Mama Kay's for the winter. Usually, it was a death sentence for the offender, because it meant the whole guild would have to sleep in the sewers to stay warm, and they would kill him for that. Still, the place was always crowded. There was a fireplace and a floor covered with soft rugs, good for sleeping on. Those rugs had once been clean, but were now stained from their filthy bodies. Despite the damage, Mama Kay never got mad at them, and every few months, new rugs showed up. There were durable chairs the guild rats were allowed to sit on, toys, dolls, and piles of games they could play. Sometimes Mama Kay even brought them treats. Here they gambled and bragged and gossiped freely with anyone who was here, even children outside their own guild. It was the only place the guild rats were allowed to resemble children. It was the only safe place they knew. Coming back, it looked different. What had seemed so recently the very lap of luxury now was just a plain room, with plain furnishings and simple toys, because the guild rats would ruin anything better. They would stain everything and break anything delicate, not from malice, but from ignorance. The place was the same. It was Azoth who had changed. Azoth, or Kylar, whichever he was, marveled at the stench of the guild rats. Didn't they smell themselves? Weren't they ashamed? Or was it just him, ashamed to see what he had been? As he always did after his reading lesson with Mama Kay, Azoth had looked for Jarl. But now that they were face to face, neither could find anything to say. "I need your help," Azoth said finally. There was no way to cover what he wanted. He wasn't here to visit a friend. He was here to do a job. "My help? I need to know what's happened to Doll Girl. Where is she? And I need to know what's happening with the guilds." "I guess you wouldn't know." "No." Guilds weren't part of his life now. Nothing was like it used to be. "Your master hit you?" Jarl asked, looking at Azoth's black eyes. "I got this in a fight. He does hit me, but not like..." Azoth cut off. "Not like Rat?" "How is he?" Azoth said, trying to cover. "Why don't you tell me? You're the one who killed him." Azoth opened his mouth, but seeing two littles in Mama Kay's front room, stopped.
"Blint made you kill Rat to see if you could do it, didn't he?"
Jarl asked, his voice low.
"No. Are you crazy?"
In his head, he could hear the echoes of Master Blint's voice from their training. Word gets out. Word always gets out. Hurt filled Jarl's eyes, and he said nothing for a long time.
"I shouldn't push, Azoth. I'm sorry. I should just thank you. Rat, he messed me up bad. I'm so confused all the time. I hated him, but sometimes, when Rat disappeared and I saw you walking away with Blint?
Jarl blinked rapidly and stared away.
Sometimes I hate you. You left me with no one. But that's not right. You didn't do anything wrong. Just Rat and me.
Azoth didn't know what to say. Jarl blinked furiously again.
Shut up, Jarl. Shut up.
He dashed the tears from his eyes with fists.
What do you need?
There was something Azoth should say. He knew it. Some assurance he should give. But he didn't know what it was. Jarl had been his friend. Was his friend, wasn't he? But he'd changed. Azoth had changed. He was supposed to be Kylar now, but instead he was just a fraud straddling two worlds and trying to hold on as they tore apart. Whatever the cataclysm named Rat had left Azoth holding on to, one thing was certain. A chasm had opened between him and Jarl, and Azoth was afraid to even approach it, didn't understand what it was, didn't know anything except that it made him feel dirty and scared. Jarl was letting him put the walls back up by asking his simple question, a simple question that could be answered simply, a problem that they could actually resolve.
"Doll girl," Azoth said.
He felt relieved to back away from his once friend, and guilty that he felt relieved.
"Oh," Jarl said. "You know she got... Is she all right now?" "She's alive. But I don't know if she's going to make it. They make fun of her. Without you around, she isn't like she used to be. I've been sharing my food with her, but the guild's falling apart. Things are too bad. We don't have enough food. The guild. Not our guild."
Azoth kept his face blank, refused to show how much that hurt. It shouldn't have hurt. He was the one who'd wanted out. He was the one who left. But it still made him feel empty. "You will be alone. You will be different. Always.
Jalaliel's almost dead.
Turns out Rat stole his review money, and now they lost the waterfront to Burning Man, and others are closing in."
"They?"
Jarl's face twisted.
"If you've got to know, they threw me out of Black Dragon, threw us all out. Didn't want buggers and rat lovers, they said."
"You don't have a guild?" Azoth asked. It was a disaster. Guild rats without a guild were fair game for anyone. That Jarl had stayed alive since being expelled was surprising. That he'd had food to share with Doll Girl was amazing. And that he was willing to was humbling.
"Some of us have banded together for a little while. They call us buggers. I'm going to try to join Two Fist on the north side. Rumor is they might get the market on Durdun soon," Jarl said.
That was Jarl. Always had a plan. "They're willing to take Doll Girl too?" He answered with guilty silence.
"I asked. I did, Azoth. They just won't do it. If you..."
Jarl's mouth opened to say more, then closed.
"I'm not going to make you ask, Jarl. I've been looking for you to give it back."
Azoth lifted his tunic and unwrapped a sash full of coins. He handed it to Jarl.
"Azoth, this is twice as heavy as it was."
"I'll take care of Doll Girl. Give me a couple weeks. Can you take care of her for that long?" Jarl's eyes were filling with tears, and Azoth was afraid his would, too. They called each other Jarl and Azoth now, not J-O and Azo. Azoth said,
"I'm going to tell Mama Kay how smart you are, and see if she has work for you. You know, if things don't work out with Two Fist..."
"You'd do that for me?"
Sure, J.O.
Azo? Jarl said.
Yeah?
Jarl hesitated. Swallowed.
I just wish...
Me too, Jarl.
Me too.
Chapter 15. The price of disobedience is death. The words kept running through his head every day as Azoth planned his disobedience. Azoth's training was brutally hard, but it wasn't brutal. In the guilds, a fist might beat you to make a point and make a mistake that left you permanently maimed. Master Blint never made mistakes. Azoth hurt exactly as much as Blint wanted him to. Usually that was a lot. But so what? Azoth had 2 meals a day. He could eat as much as he wanted, and Blint worked the soreness out of his muscles every day as they trained. At first, everything was curses and beatings. Azoth couldn't do anything right. But curses were just air, and beatings were just momentary pain. Blint would never maim Azoth, and if he chose to kill him, there was nothing Azoth could do to stop him anyway. It was the closest thing to safety he'd ever known. Within weeks, he realized he liked the training, the sparring, the blunted practice weapons, the obstacle courses, even the herb lore. Learning reading with Mama Kay was hard, but so what? 2 hours of frustration a day was nothing. Azoth's life was good. Within a month, he realized that he was talented. It wasn't obvious, and if he hadn't been so keyed into Master Blint's every mood and reaction, he would never have noticed. But now and then, he'd see a faint look of surprise as he mastered some new skill more quickly than Master Blint had expected. It made him work all the harder, hoping to see that look not once a week, but once a day. For her part, Mama Kay made him decipher squiggles for longer than he could imagine. She had a way of smiling and saying just the right thing, that it pulled him along through the hours. Words were power, she said. Words were another sword for the man who wielded them well. And he would need them if the world was to believe that he was Kylar Stern. So Mama Kay worked with him on his alternate identity, quizzing him with likely questions other nobles would ask, helping him come up with harmless stories about growing up in Eastern Cenaria, and teaching him the rudiments of etiquette. She told him Count Drake would teach him the rest once he went to live with the Drakes. When Azoth walked in the Drake's door, she said, he would be Kylar forever after. Blint would train him in a safe house on the east side. Mama Kay would meet with him in one of her homes on the east side. Only when he started accompanying Blint on jobs would he return to the Warrens. Azoth worked hard for her, and without complaint, except for one time when he got disgusted at his own stupidity and threw a book across the room. He worked in the hell of Mama Kay's displeasure for a week until he brought her some flowers he'd stolen, and she forgave him. He'd given Jarl plenty of money to take care of Doll Girl, but Jarl wouldn't be able to give her the money. Someone would steal it. The worst part of it was that she was alone, mute, and with a horribly beaten face. She wouldn't be making any friends either. The price of disobedience is death, Master Blint had said, and he'd forbidden him to see Doll Girl again. Ever. Mama Kay told Azoth that Master Blint would eventually come to like him and trust him, but that when he said things like that, for now, Azoth should take it as law. That made Azoth hopeful, until she clarified. Street law, which was immutable and omnipotent, not the pathetic king's law. It was a shame, because Azoth had to see Doll Girl one last time. When he did get his chance, it was through no guile of his own. Master Blint had a job, so he simply left Azoth to his own devices. He left a list of chores, too,
but Azoth knew that if he hurried, he could finish all the chores and still have several hours before he was supposed to meet with Mama Kay for his reading lesson. He threw himself into his work with a fury. He dusted the weapons room, climbing up on a ladder to reach the higher rows of weapons and the equipment out of his reach. He checked and cleaned the wood practice weapons. He oiled and cleaned the weapons Master Blint had used recently. He worked a different kind of oil into the leather targets and dummies that Master Blint made him attack by the hour. He checked the seams on the ones Master Blint himself had kicked, and finding several burst, sewed them shut again. He wasn't very good with a needle, but Master Blint tolerated less than perfect work here, if nowhere else. He swept the floor, and, as always, didn't throw the dirt out into the street, but collected it in a small bin. Master Blint didn't want him to leave the safe house, not ever, unless he was under direct orders. He found himself cleaning one of Blint's daggers a second time. It was a long, thin blade with tiny gold filigree. Through chance or age, the gold was thin in the grooves that had been etched for it, so blood had collected in every narrow groove of the filigree. Blint had used this blade recently, and he must have been in a hurry when he sheathed it. So Azoth found himself using the point of another fine dagger to pick out the blood. He should have soaked the blade in water and then scrubbed it vigorously. But this was his last chore. It was still 3 hours until he was supposed to be at Mama Kay's. If he had to work on chores until then, it wouldn't be his fault that he didn't leave. "What happens if you do nothing?" Blint had asked him. "Nothing. There's a price, and a terrible freedom to that boy. Remember it." Master Blint had been speaking of making your move on a debtor when things looked risky. But Azoth could feel the burden of those words now. "If I do something, what's the worst that could happen? Master Blint kills me." That was pretty bad. The odds of it were low, though. Unlike other wet boys who might spend their whole lives in the Warrens, Master Blint only took jobs from people who could afford his prices. That usually meant nobles. That always meant East Side. So he'd be on the opposite side of the city from Azoth. The real worst case, if I do nothing? Doll Girl dies. He put down the dagger with a grimace. Finding Doll Girl was easier said than done. The Black Dragon Guild had ceased to exist. It was just gone. Kylar went to their old territory and found that it had been swallowed by Red Hand, Burning Man, and Rusty Knife. The old black dragons scrawled on buildings and aqueducts were already fading. He wore a pair of daggers, but he didn't have to use them. Once, he was stopped by some burning men, but one of the bigs used to be one of his lizards. The boy spoke a few words to the others who were about to try to rob Azoth, and they eased away. The lizard never said a word to him. He crisscrossed their old territory half a dozen times, but he never found Doll Girl. Once, he thought he saw Corbin Fishhill, someone he'd always known was important, and who he now knew, Master Blint had told him, was one of the Nine. But all the guild rats he saw kept their distance. Time was running out when Azoth finally thought of the old bakery. Doll Girl was there. Alone. She had her back to him, and for a moment he paused, afraid to get her attention. Then she turned. Rat's sadism was evident. A month hadn't been long enough for her wounds to heal. It had only been long enough to show both what her face must have looked like for the last weeks, and what it would look like for the rest of her life. Rat had beaten her first, just beat her into submission or unconsciousness. Then he'd taken a knife to her face. One deep cut looped from the corner of her left eye to the corner of her mouth. It had been stitched with dozens of tiny stitches, but the resulting scar would tug the corner of Doll Girl's mouth up into an unnatural grin forever. Her other cheek bore a broad X-shaped cut, which was matched again by a smaller X across her lips in front. Eating, smiling, frowning. Moving her mouth at all must have been excruciating. One of her eyes was still swollen, and Azoth wasn't sure if she'd ever be able to see out of it again. The rest of the wounds looked like they would fade. A scab on her forehead, the barest yellow around her other eye as the black faded, and a nose that must have been reset because Azoth was sure Rat had broken it. All in all, her face was, and was supposed to be, a testament to cruelty. Rat wanted anyone who ever looked at Doll Girl to know that she hadn't just had an accident. He wanted everyone to know that this had been done deliberately. For a moment, Azoth wished Rat's death had been even more horrible. Then, time seemed to start again. He was staring at Doll Girl, staring at his friend's face with open horror. Her eyes, that had been so full of surprise and sudden hope, brimmed full with tears. She covered herself and turned away, crying silently, her thin shoulders shaking. He sat next to her.
"I came as soon as I could. I've got a master now, and I had to disobey him just to be here, but I couldn't leave you here." "Things have been bad, huh?"
She started sobbing. He could just imagine the names they must have called her. Sometimes he wanted to kill everyone in the Warrens. How could they make fun of Doll Girl? How could they hurt her? It was a miracle she was still alive. A miracle. And Jarl. Jarl must have risked his life a dozen times. Azoth scooted over and pulled her close. She turned and clung to him, as if her tears would wash away. He held her and cried. Time passed. Azoth felt like he'd been squeezed dry. He wasn't sure how long he'd held her, but he knew it had been too long.
"I have good news," he told her.
She looked up at him with those big brown eyes.
"Come with me,"
he said. Doll Girl followed him out of the Warrens, over the Vanden Bridge, and to Count Drake's. Her eyes widened as they headed toward the Count's house, and further when the old porter opened the door for Azoth and showed them in. Count Drake was in his office. He rose and ushered them in, somehow not even registering surprise at how awful Doll Girl's face looked. He was a better person than Azoth. "Has Azoth told you why you're here, young lady?" the Count asked. The name was a deliberate choice, Azoth saw. Doll Girl was part of Azoth's life. She wouldn't be part of Kylar's. She wasn't going to know his new name. Doll Girl shook her head shyly, clinging to Azoth. "We've found a family for you, Doll Girl," Count Drake said. "They want you to come and be their daughter. They're going to take care of you. You'll never have to sleep on the streets again. They serve in a house here on the east side. If you don't want to, you never have to go back to the Warrens ever again." Of course, it had all been a little more involved than that. Count Drake had known the family for some time. They had taken in other slave-born orphans over the years, but couldn't afford to feed another. So Azoth had sworn that he would provide for her out of his wages, which were already generous, and which Master Blint had told him would increase as he became more useful. Count Drake hadn't been enamored of keeping any secret from Master Blint, but after Azoth had explained what had happened, he'd been willing to help. Doll Girl clung to Azoth, either not understanding or not believing what the Count had just said. Count Drake stood.
"Well, I'm sure you have some things you probably wish to tell her, and I need to get the coach in order, so if you'll excuse me."
He left them alone, and Dahlgirl looked at Azoth with accusing eyes.
"You never were dumb," he said. She squeezed his hand, hard. "My master ordered me not to see you. Today is the last time we ever get to see each other." She tugged on his hand, face pugnacious. "Yes. Ever," he said. "I don't want it to be this way, but he'll kill me if he finds out I defied him even this much. I'm sorry. Please don't be mad at me."
She was crying again, and there was nothing he could do. "I have to go now. He might be back any time.
I'm sorry."
He tore his eyes away from her and stepped toward the door.
"Don't leave me."
The voice sent a lance of ice down his spine. He turned, incredulous. It was a little girl voice, exactly like you'd expect if you didn't know Dahlgirl was a mute.
"Please,"
Dahlgirl said. It was a pretty voice, incongruous coming out of a beaten mask of a face Rat had left her. Azoth's eyes filled with tears again, and he ran out the door. Straight into someone tall and lean and as hard as if he'd been cut out of solid rock. Azoth fell on his butt and stared up in horror. Master Blint's face was purple with fury.
"You dare?" he shouted. "After all I've done for you, you defy me? I just killed one of the Nine, and what do? You walk around the killing ground for 2 hours so everyone knows Blint's apprentice was there. You may have cost me everything."
He swept Azoth off the ground as if he were a kitten and hit him. Azoth's tunic tore in Blint's hand as he fell back from the force of the blow. But Blint came forward, and this time his closed fist crashed against Azoth's jaw. Azoth's face rebounded off the Count's floor, and he barely saw Dahlgirl flying at Master Blint as the huge black sword cleared its sheath.
"Don't hurt her!"
Azoth shouted. Insanely, he threw himself at Blint and grabbed Retribution's blade. But Blint was a force of nature. He didn't even slow as he scooped Dahlgirl up and deposited her in the hall. He locked the door, unlocked it, and relocked it in rapid succession. He turned back to Azoth, but whatever he was about to say died. The great black sword was still locked in Azoth's hand, cutting to the bone, except that now it wasn't black. The blade was glowing blue. Incandescent blue fire surrounded Azoth's hand, burning cold into his cut fingers, spreading down the blade.
"No, not that. It's mine," Blint cried.
He flung the sword aside as if it were an adder, away from both of them. If there had been fury in his eyes before, now it turned to absolute, unreasoning rage. Azoth didn't even see the first blow. He didn't even know how he'd reached the floor again. Something wet and sticky was blocking out his vision. Then the world faded into repeated heavy blows and exploding light and pain and the sharp, garlicky breath of Master Blint and the distant shouting and banging on a door that seemed further and further away.
Chapter 16. Durzo gazed into the frothy brown ale as if it held answers. It didn't. And he had a choice to make. The usual forced gaiety of the brothel swirled around him,
but nobody, male or female, bothered him. Perhaps it was retribution unsheathed on the table in front of him. Perhaps it was merely the look on his face. "Don't hurt her," Azoth had yelled. As if Durzo would murder some 7-year-old girl. What kind of a monster did the boy think he was? Then he remembered beating the shit out of the boy, artlessly pounding that yielding child flesh, beating him unconscious before Count Drake broke the door down and grabbed him. He'd almost killed Count Drake for that, he'd been so wild. The Count had fixed such a look on Durzo. Damn Count Drake, and damn his holy eyes. That incandescent blue. Damn it. Damn all magic. In that flash of blue on retribution, he'd seen his hope die. The hope had been dying since Vonda died, but that blue was a door slamming shut forever. It meant Azoth was worthy, as Durzo was not. As if all of Durzo's years of service were worth nothing, the boy was taking from him all that made him special. What did that leave for Durzo Blint? Ashes. Ashes and blood. And nothing more. Suddenly, the sword retribution before him seemed a mockery. Retribution? Giving people what they deserve? If I really did that, I'd shove the damn blade down my own throat. The last time he'd been so close to madness had been when Vonda died. 4 months and 6 days ago. Sighing, he swirled the ale around in the glass, but he didn't drink. Time enough for that later. Later. After he made his decision, he'd need a drink. He'd need 12, no matter what he decided. He'd drunk a lot with Vonda. It pissed her sister off. Of course, the whole relationship had pissed Mama Kay off. She'd forbidden Durzo to see her innocent little sister. She'd forbidden Vonda to see the wet boy. Mama Kay, so smart in other matters, had probably done more to get their relationship going than anything. Surrounded by easy flesh, whether he paid for it or not, Guinevere's little sister was suddenly intriguing. He wanted to know if the virginal bit was an act. It was. He'd been disappointed, but had hidden it. It was hypocrisy anyway, and she'd had plenty of other mysteries. Vonda didn't always treat him well, but at least she didn't fear him. He didn't think she understood him enough to fear him. She seemed to just glide along on the surface of life, while others had to plunge into the sewer water. Durzo hadn't understood her, and it entranced him. After their affair started, he might have kept it a secret. He could have. He knew Guinevere's schedule well enough that they could have kept things going for years. Even with Guinevere's insight, Durzo knew how to be inscrutable. But it hadn't happened. Vonda had told her, probably announced it immediately, if Durzo knew Vonda. It might have been a little callous, but Vonda didn't know what she was doing. "End this now, Durzo Blint," Guinevere had told him quite calmly. "She'll destroy you. I love my sister, but she will be your ruin." It had all been words. Words to get Guinevere's way, as always. With all her power, it infuriated her that she couldn't run the lives of those she really wanted to. She'd been right, of course. Maybe not in the way she had meant it. But she'd been right. Guinevere always had understood him better than anyone else, and he'd understood her. They were mirrors to each other. Guinevere Kirenna would have been perfect for him if he could love what he saw in the mirror. Why am I thinking about this? It's all old shit. There was a choice to be made. Did he raise the boy and hope, or did he kill him now? Hope. Right.
Hope is the lies we tell ourselves about the future. He'd hoped before, dared to dream about a different life. But when it came time...
You look pale.